Okay, we're going to be in, try to wrap up Genesis this morning. I'd like to just touch on a couple of things in chapter 45, and then we'll try to go through the rest of these chapters at the end of Genesis. And the Lord willing, we'll try to take up next week with Leviticus. If you want to be reading the first few chapters of Leviticus, I know it's been true for me most all my life, and probably it is for you too, that reading Leviticus is pretty hard. It's hard to understand why all that stuff is written down. And but I think as I've gotten older, I've learned to appreciate some things about it that I hope will be good lessons for us. And so we won't be going verse by verse or anything like that, but we'll try to take sections of it and think about things that I believe really are good lessons for the Old Testament people of God, and so many of them good lessons for us today too. Terry, you want to lead a prayer for us this morning? In chapter 45, it picks up Joseph's brothers, including Benjamin, have come back now for the second time, brought Benjamin back with them, and they are about in chapter 45 to be reunited with Joseph, or Joseph reveals to them who he is. This is told about in chapter 45. And then, of course, you know that this led to the Jacob's family being their father and all of his family being brought down to Egypt, and was the beginning of the shaping of Israel into a great nation, as God had promised to Abraham. I just want to notice a couple of things in the first part of chapter 45. If you look at verse 4, Joseph is overcome with emotion, seeing them, and he's going to reveal himself to them. He says, "I'm Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt." They are, actually, at first he says in verse 3, "I'm Joseph," and they are in shock. They don't know what to say. He repeats this, but look at what he says. I think this is a wonderful statement by Joseph, and he repeats something similar to this. It tells about this again in chapter 50. But look at verse 5. He says, "Do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you who sent me here, but God. And He's made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler throughout all the land of Egypt." What do you see in Joseph's statement to them there's a great lesson for us, a great picture of something else in the Bible? Pardon? Yeah, and his view of this, after all that they had done to him, his view of this is what? That this worked really for God's plan. It worked for salvation. It worked for preserving the lives of his brothers and his family, and many, many other people also were preserved here. But I think it's interesting that Joseph looks at it this way. Terry? And I hope we'll see this as we go through the Old Testament and into the New Testament, This Joseph, in this way, was a picture of Christ. He was a type of Christ, and many people have seen him that way. But he was also, I think, a good example about how this can happen more often than we know. Sometimes we go through things that we don't want to face, we don't want to tackle, we hate to have to go through it, and then we may look back later and realize, you know, that was really a good thing for me. Most of us have things we look back on our childhood and maybe things that we didn't enjoy at the time that our parents made us do or things that they put us through. But looking back, we may say, you know, that was a good thing for me. That was something that helped me prepare for whatever. But I think this is true spiritually too, that things that we go through that may be trials and there may be things we wish we could avoid at times, they can wind up being the means to strengthen us, to help our families, to help us know what to say to our brothers and sisters, to be in a position to help carry them through a difficult time. Think about the impact on Joseph's brothers right now. They had been, a lot of them, had been pretty much scoundrels. They had been in a lot of trouble. They had disappointed their father. They had gone against what God said many times. They carried this lie in their hearts for many years. They carried the guilt and the fear of that. And now, all of a sudden, things change. We don't have details about all of them, but they see Joseph in a different way. Do you think maybe they learned something about forgiveness? I don't know if you've ever been in a situation like this. If you look a little bit further down in verse 14 and 15, he cries with them, hugs them, kisses them, embraces them, almost as if nothing ever happened, almost as if there was no separation between them, or there had not been any separation between them. And I just wonder if those brothers that night must not have scratched their heads a little bit and thought, that's really an amazing thing that Joseph was willing, after all of this, that he was willing to forgive us, to take us back, to take care of us, that his view of what all has happened, in spite of how evil we were, how wicked we were, his view of this is, God put me in a position where I could help work out His plan, help His will be accomplished. We ought to think about, I think, the power of forgiveness. The power of forgiveness. Joseph did an amazing amount of good here to teach his brothers, to teach their families, to help them see what God meant when sometimes things are not going our way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is really not dealt with in Genesis, but I want you to think about it because we're going into Leviticus and we're going to be talking a lot about atonement and about reconciliation and about bearing sin. And I want you to just think about how in a very real way Joseph bore the sins of his brothers. He was bearing the sins of his brothers when he didn't look at it as if, look what they've done to me. He looked at it as if, look how God used me to deliver them. Look how God used me to help them, help unfold His plan to bless the seed of Abraham, to bless all nations through the seed of Abraham. Look how God used me that way. And sometimes there are ways, not that we are capable of saving anyone ourselves. I don't mean that. But there are times when we have to bear the sins of our brothers and sisters. We have to be patient. We have to bear with them. We have to try to find ways to restore them, to help them turn toward forgiveness and repentance and confession. We have to work that way unselfishly. And in that way, we are bearing their sins. We're bearing their burdens. We're bearing their... I don't mean like Jesus did. I'm not trying to say like that. But we are working with them. We're looking out not for ourselves, but for their good. When by human standards, we might say, well, I don't owe him anything. You know, from just a worldly standpoint, we say, you know, he did me wrong. I don't owe him anything. And Joseph could have easily done that. But I think he gives us a great picture of forgiveness, of reconciliation, of trying to see ourselves not as just in this world to get what I deserve, but in this world to help God's will be accomplished and help others fit into that, help others be a part of that, be blessed according to that.
This came about because of both parties' willingness to repent.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph learned things about his brothers that he didn't realize and about his dad.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll remember, he named his son Manasseh, which meant forgetfulness. And he makes a statement, I'm able to forget my father's house.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a guy now that for 10 years could have reconciled himself to his dad.
Yes.
But he chose not to, but he hears how his brothers had turned into something he didn't realize they could do or be. And it automatically shifts his concept to what repentance and forgiveness is really all about. Forgiveness is made possible when both parties are willing to acknowledge change and go about life. And now he really can focus and see the whole of God's intentions.
It shows what a great influence a little good influence can have. A little conforming ourselves to the will of God that may elicit that response from somebody else, that may help them turn, that may help them say, I see what you mean, I'm sorry too, I did wrong in this, I need to be forgiven. And that's what, I appreciate Steve mentioning that, that's what true reconciliation is. When you have the willingness to forgive and you have the willingness to repent, you have the both parties right with God and right with each other. And it is indeed a beautiful story. I also thought maybe just in passing, just to mention something about Jacob. When they go back to get Jacob and tell him what's going on and to bring Jacob down into the land, you remember that back when they had first come to talk to him about taking Benjamin, he was really... upset about this, and he said, everything's against me, something to that effect. Everything's against me. Everything's working in the wrong way. But a little bit later now, he begins to look at things differently. All that had transpired between Joseph and his brothers and Jacob, he begins to think a little bit differently. And he says first when he released Benjamin to go, he said, in essence, I'm going to put him in your care, and if I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved. But now here in verse 28, when they come back to tell him, he says, it's enough. Joseph's alive. I'll go and see him before I die. Let me just get a look at him before I die. Um, I don't know that Jacob could have seen that this would have ever been a possibility. He thought Joseph was dead and gone, and so I'm not trying to blame him at all for that. But I think it's an illustration here when Jacob comes to the realization of what has happened, and he sits back a little bit and he says, you know, now it doesn't matter what happens to me. If I can just go and see him before I'm put in my grave, that's enough. And I wonder sometimes if we couldn't profit from more of an attitude like Jacob has to look back and think about what things are really important. Sometimes we get in a fret and in a turmoil about a lot of things that really are not, in the long run, they're not that important. And maybe they dominate our lives. They dominate our schedules. We spend all our time on it. And we need to learn, I think, to back up a little bit and to think about what's really important here. What's really, how can I rest in God and realize that He promises His people He's going to take care of them? Let me do that. Even if it might be hard, even if I might go through some hard times, let me just rest in what God says. God tells him before he leaves, chapter 46, look at verse 3. God calls to him in verse 2, and he says, "Do not fear, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I'll go down with you to Egypt, and I will surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes." When God tells Jacob, don't be afraid to go down there, this is part of the plan that I promised to your forefathers. What do you see Jacob doing from now on? How does he take that? Pardon? It lifts him up. But what does he do now when he goes down to Egypt? What do we learn about Jacob in the rest of this book? Basically, three things. He sees Joseph and he says, I'm ready to die now. And then he blesses Joseph's sons, and then he has the final blessing for his other sons. And we won't go through all of the details of those, but what's he doing? When he's doing that, when he's blessing Joseph's sons, when he's calling his own sons to him, and he's giving... He says, I'm going to tell what the future holds. And it says a little bit later that he blessed all of them. What's he doing?
Passing it on.
Yeah. I don't know. I see this as him, maybe that's a good way to put it. He's going to die. He's got to leave it in his son's hands. He's got to leave this in Joseph and his son's hands and then his other sons. He's got to, he's done all he can do, so to speak. And I don't know, I just wonder if Jacob didn't look back over his life and feel like, look how many times I messed it up. Look how many times I made the wrong choice or did things for the wrong reason. And He recognizes, I got to let it go now. And I think when we come to that realization, when we get late in life and we realize I'm not going to be here much longer, it kind of sobers you up a little bit. And typically what we want to try to do, I think, is talk to our children. Talk to those people who we've got to pass things on to. Maybe it's sometimes our children, sometimes maybe it's others, but I think there's this desire to do this. And
I think probably he wanted them to be so close and love each other and mm-hmm. he that way he would feel
I'm sure thinking about the promises of God in a little bit of a different way. Whereas in earlier in his life, he was independent. He was maybe conniving a lot of times. He tried to do it on his own. He tried to, deceive his father, deceive Esau. You know, he battled with Laban, and they were back and forth. He kind of took it on himself as, figuring out how to get things done. But now, he can't really get anything done except pass this blessing, turn it over to other people, turn it over to his sons. And I think he's thinking now about the plan of God and what's going to happen. When he talks about what happened in the blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh that you remember that was significant. Okay. The natural order would have been Manasseh would be he was the firstborn, and he would have been the one who would receive the birthright, so to speak, or special. By the way, it seems like when Jacob does this, this may have been his way of, he had been separated from Joseph all this time. Joseph has these two sons by an Egyptian priest's daughter, and they grew up outside the family. They don't know the family. They don't know, it's like they're strangers, and maybe Jacob is welcoming them into the family, and he wants to bless Ephraim with the greater blessing, and Joseph says, no, you've got them mixed up. But Jacob said, no, I know what I'm doing. And he speaks about how Ephraim would be greater than Manasseh. And we'll see this very soon. That's exactly what happened. Kathy?
It's kind of like him and Esau.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And we'll touch on that maybe before we close this morning. But it's another illustration, I think, of God's election. Not talking about salvation here, but talking about God's choosing the one He wants to help unfold the things that He has in mind. So Manasseh later kind of recedes to the background, and Ephraim actually becomes a prominent leading tribe in Israel. In fact, on over in the time of the prophets, the whole northern kingdom became known as Ephraim. It was referred to as Ephraim many times because he had a very prominent place. Well, what about in chapter 49 in Jacob's blessing of his other sons? What do you see in there that maybe good for us to think a little bit about? Sometimes reading through for several of these, it may not seem like much of a blessing what he says about several of these sons. In fact, for most of them, he has some sharp criticism of what they had done, for especially Reuben and Simeon and Levi, some specific criticism of the way choices they had made and the way they had lived. Others, he seems to maybe just say something about their characteristic that may be not either good or bad. But for, as Kathy said, for Judah, there's a special emphasis given to Judah. I think maybe Judah and Joseph, to me, kind of stand out here when Jacob is blessing them. So what does he say about Judah? Okay. This is really a beautiful passage from the Old Testament, from Genesis. Especially, let's see, he starts with Judah about verse 8. And he talks about his brethren praising him and his hand being on the neck of his enemies, and his father's sons will bow before you. Judah is before him. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lioness. Who shall rouse him up? And then look at verse 10 especially. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the obedience of the peoples be. So verse 10 especially, one of those ancient prophecies about Christ: the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the obedience of the peoples be. So what does that mean? The scepter will not depart from Judah. What's a scepter? Yeah, that's right. That's what a king had, a staff that had maybe some type of a crown or emblem of some kind on it of his authority, and it was something when he was sitting on the throne, he would have his scepter in his hand. It was a symbol of his authority. And but yes, sometimes they would have a seal. So what did he mean? The scepter will not depart from Judah. Think about this. This is 300 and some years before Israel would even go out of Egypt. Pardon? Yeah, that the scepter would not. It's not saying it wouldn't depart from the land of Judah. It's saying it would not depart from the family of Judah. That is, I think what he's saying is that when the kingship, when the royal line is established in Judah, it would be handed down to Christ, and it would never pass from Judah. It gives what?
I see him, but not now. Behold, but not here. A star shall come forth from Jacob, and a scepter shall rise from Israel. He shall cross through the forehead of Moab, and shall come on the sun of Seth. And he shall be possession, serving, sire, and his house shall be possession. For he will perform. The one from Jacob shall have his name, and his house shall remember the city.
Okay. So connect this to the promise to Abraham to bless all nations. What he's saying is this is going to come through Judah. This will come through the line of Judah.
Okay.
That's right. That was a name, an Old Testament name, that was applied to Christ. It's a name that means peace or something akin to that, something about peace. It's really a remarkable thing that there was no thought of a king for this nation right now. They were about to become slaves, in fact. They were coming down and settling in Egypt and eventually going to become slaves. So there was really no thought about a king. And yet Jacob speaks this prophetically to say, Judah, you're a specially blessed son, because you're the one through whom the king will come. You're the one that will carry the royal line that will not pass away until the king comes, until the eternal king comes, until the Messiah comes. So this is really a striking prophecy compared to the other, to what he says about the other sons. He also has a lot to say about Joseph. Joseph is a fruit, verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a fountain. His branches run over the wall. He talks about Jacob's strength and that God was going to keep him and take care of him and bless him. And of course, Jacob, in a sense, received a double portion in terms of the inheritance among the tribe, because his two sons. So how does that work? There were 12 sons. 12 tribes, but Joseph got two, so how does that work? What happened to the other one? In terms of the inheritance in the land, it was part, okay, Levi, in fact, he mentions it here, Levi would not have an inheritance in the land. They would be spread throughout all the land, and they would be cared for by the others, so they wouldn't have their own inheritance. So the 12 tribes were the 11 sons of Jacob, and then Joseph's two sons. The 11 sons, the 10 sons of Jacob, and then Joseph's two sons. Okay, look right at the end of chapter 49, if you would. And if y'all see something else in here that you want to spend time on, please speak up or ask a question about that. I'd be happy to. I just wanted to try to wrap up in Genesis if we can this morning. What happens to Jacob when he died then? Okay. Well, that was Joseph. But what about Jacob? What happened to him? Yeah. Jacob says, take me back and bury me back there with my fathers. In that, you remember the field that Abraham had bought, and where so many of them had been buried, the forefathers. And it's really interesting what it says here. Joseph tells Pharaoh, I want to go back and bury my father. And if you read this, what kind of funeral did Jacob have? Huh? He had a big one, and it was almost like it was an Egyptian funeral. I mean, all these officers and chariots from Egypt take his body back to the land of Canaan. And I don't know whether they went all the way to the actual burial place. It mentions a place called Atad, which I don't know where that is, but somewhere in Canaan. They stop and they have this great service, and the people around look and say, what are all those Egyptians doing out there, you know, making that great mourning? It's kind of a striking thing here that Jacob, a shepherd from Canaan, who really didn't know, you know, I mean, he was down in Egypt for a few years, but he had no power or no control there. But because of their respect for Joseph, they take his body up and they make a big production out of Jacob's burial and taking him back to the land where he had come from. And as Terry said, when you get over to chapter 50, the same, Joseph is also going to be embalmed and put in a coffin in Egypt. And his wish was, when you go out of here, think about that. Think about Joseph's faith. When you leave this land, take my bones with you. Joseph had been, you might say, for all practical purposes, an Egyptian. He had been, trained that way and groomed that way, not raised that way, but he had become such a powerful man in Egypt. And yet when he dies, he says, take my bones back. When y'all go out of this country, take my bones back. And I can't help but think about this burial ground that was there in Canaan. I wish I could go there and see that one day. But to be there where Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, where they had been buried, and where each one would say, put my bones back here, even though they didn't own the land at that time. They didn't own the land. They just knew that God had promised it to them. And so they said, put my bones there. Abraham said, bury Sarah right there, because one day my people are going to come back and they're going to be here in this land. And to me, it's a striking thing that these generations passed along.
It doesn't specifically say it, but Joseph mentions, I want my bones carried back. But I would imagine when they took Joseph's bones, they probably took his brother's
with them. That's a good point, because they had such a consciousness of this, of their father being there. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that either, but that would make sense that they would have wanted to have their whole, the whole family back there. That's a great point. Look at verse 20, first of all, verse 15, after Jacob dies, Joseph's brothers get worried. What do they think? Yeah, maybe Joseph will want to get them back now, because their father's gone. There's nothing to restrain Joseph from just taking revenge on them. And here you see Joseph They basically asked forgiveness, or mentioned that Jacob had encouraged them to ask forgiveness to him. But look at verse 19. Joseph said to them, fear not, for am I in the place of God? And as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it to pass, as it is this day, to save much people alive. Now therefore fear ye not, I will nourish you and your little ones. And he comforted them, and he spake kindly to them. I don't want to pass by that verse without just thinking about this idea. In the New Testament, there's a passage in Romans chapter 8, that speaks about all things work together for good to them that love the Lord and that are called according to His purpose. And we could spend a lot of time talking about exactly what that means, but the idea seems to be that even when God's people are going through difficult times, that those that remain faithful to Him, that He knows how to make a blessing out of that. He knows how to bring good from evil, how to bring blessing from trouble. And I see this passage in Genesis, what Joseph said, is much the same idea. Joseph looking at what he had been through and recognizing that God was able to bring blessing out of trouble. He was able to bring the unfolding, the implementation of His plan through His providence and all the things that had happened to Joseph. And I'm sure when Joseph was going through many of it, he must have felt so unjustly treated. He must have felt like, why do I have to go through this? And yet it's a great thing about Joseph that he could look back and say, God was working all this time. God sent me down here. God allowed this to transpire because He had in mind something far greater. He had in mind a bigger picture than I could see in my little circumstances. Yes, yeah. And I think a point that I just want us to be sure and try to think a little bit about is that we should be compelled by our faith to try to look at the bigger picture, to try to see deeper than other people see, to try to see the meaning of things from a broader perspective than the world around us. Sometimes, unfortunately, Christians are not a very good example in that regard. Maybe they go through hard times and it makes them bitter. It makes them turn against God. It makes them go on strike and, well, I'll show them. It makes them do things that, and they may be right in their assessment. They may have been unfairly treated. They may have had a hard way to go. But to begin to look at it as if God has forgotten me, he doesn't care anymore. To look at it that way is a great mistake. We need to learn by faith to see that God is a God who cares for His people, and that a God who uses even adversity to bless and strengthen His people and to bless and strengthen others. To me, this is a great conclusion in Genesis, because it really points back to a few things that we said right at the beginning. Remember when we talked about great themes in Genesis? What was one of them? The great theme in Genesis. What about Abraham? Faith. Faith is front and center. Obedient faith is a linchpin in Genesis. People who act according to the way things are from God, not to the way things look where we're walking in our circumstances, where we're walking around the world, on the earth. Abraham looked at the promises of God. He put his trust in spiritual things even when circumstances around him were not very conducive to that. Even when maybe he didn't have the proof, when he didn't have he didn't have the tangible thing he could see, but he put his faith in the God that he couldn't see, but he trusted in. And he acted that way. Another great theme in Genesis, I think, is suffering. We talked about this a little bit at the beginning. Sometimes we suffer because of the injustice of others. Sometimes we suffer because of our own sins. Sometimes we suffer on behalf of other people. Joseph suffered on behalf of his brothers and his family. To let our faith carry us through this, and to be able to see when bad things come our way, when something happens that doesn't seem to be going the right way, to try to look at it in a different way than we might naturally be inclined to try to think, is God using me to help others? Is God trying to teach me a lesson? Is God trying to open another door that will prepare for another blessing? Am I just bearing up for the sins of other people? Am I enduring them for something that will be clearer down the road? To try to look at things that way, I think it's a great lesson in Genesis. You see it in Abraham, you see it in Joseph, you see it in Jacob sometimes in his life, you see it in other characters in Genesis, in Noah and Enoch and many others. And then finally, let's just think about election. Remember how God chose Abraham over all the others, how He chose Jacob over Esau, how He chose Isaac over Ishmael, how He chose Joseph, or He chose Ephraim over Manasseh. Or again, not to say Esau's going to hell and Jacob's going to heaven. Ishmael's... that wasn't the point. The point was, here is my... this is the one I have chosen to advance my cause, to move things further, to bring about my plan in the earth. And when Paul talks about this in Romans, he says to the Jews, basically, who are you that question God? If God says, this is how I chose to unfold my plan, who are you to say you don't know what you're doing? Election is a great theme in Genesis, that God chooses to unfold His plan to bless all nations through the seed of Abraham. He chooses that in the way that He knows best, in the way that's best for us. Anybody want to make another comment before we close up? I hope you have learned from Genesis. There are a lot of things that we could have spent more time on, but we've probably spent more time than we should have. But we'll try. Steve's working on Exodus right now, and I think I'm going to pretty much let him go ahead and do that in his lessons and classes. We're going to shift over to Leviticus next week. So if you can read the first few chapters there, we'll try to get started on that. Thank you very much.